Proverbs chapter 21. And the next verse, as we work our way through this chapter, is verse 9, which reads, "Better to dwell in a corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman." Anybody wonder why I postponed this verse from last week to this week? Let's keep your place here. No. Look a little further in this chapter. Yes. A few verses down, verse 19. Solomon writes, "Better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and angry woman." And yes, let's keep our place here and turn just a little further in this book to chapter 25. Chapter 25 and verse 24. "It is better to dwell in a corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman." So three verses that are all dealing with a similar issue. Back to chapter 21 now. Actually, there are 19 of these better than proverbs in this book. It's better to do such and such than to do the other. 19 of those, a number of those are given to this particular comparison and warning. The specific point obviously being made here in verses 9, which we're looking at now, and later in verse 19, is the reference to living in a cramped quarters. It's called the corner of a rooftop. And in that culture, most of the roofs were flat. The corner of a flat roof, or as it was in verse 19, in the wilderness, in a desert area, better to do that, where one can at least have some peace and quiet rather than in a spacious house with an argumentative, contentious wife. And what's the point? Well, a wife who causes strife makes the home unpleasant, undesirable. And I would add, the cumulative effect of that is that the reverse is happening. Perhaps the reason she is being contentious is she is upset with what the husband is doing and wants to correct that, wants to get it right. But the actual effect is that she's driving her husband away, right? So rather than bringing her to her, it's creating the atmosphere that drives him away. William MacDonald observes, "Houses in Bible lands normally had flat roofs. This proverb says that it would be better to live alone in a cramped corner of one of those roofs." Now think of this. I just looked down at the bank behind us. I don't know if you've seen that when you've been in the back of our yard. The Bank of Cadiz has a little auxiliary building, and it was a flat roof. Those are bad ideas in our area. I don't understand why you put a flat roof on anything. But they came back finally after multiple times of trying to correct it, and they put rafters in, and now it's going to be a better situation. It used to be a flat roof. But on the flat roof, obviously, that's it. You're exposed. So MacDonald points out what Solomon is saying is it's better to live in a cramped corner of one of those roofs where you're exposed to heat and cold and rain and sleet and snow, etc., etc., than to live in a house shared with a nagging, cantankerous woman. He observes the storms from without would be more endurable than the tempest inside. And when I was finishing that the other week, I thought of the little comment that Fox News puts up, "We report, you decide." So, there. Any comments or observations?
Sounds like you spoke from personal experience.
Well, with 300 wives and 700 concubines, I think he probably had a few of them in there.
And he only put in 19 of them.
Yeah. That's good.
Chosen to work 20-hour days instead of go home.
difficult, difficult situation. Yeah. Verse number 10. The soul of the wicked desires evil. His neighbor finds no favor in his eyes. The soul of the wicked desires evil. Think of that. It desires evil. That's what it wants. His neighbor finds no favor in his eyes. Derek Kidner, I often quote from him, offered a statement in connection with this verse that we do well to put into our mental hoppers and keep close at hand. He observes that what Solomon is saying here is an important truth about depravity. There's a word that we don't use often, but that doesn't mean that it's not real and very appropriate at all times, frankly. What Solomon is saying here is an important truth about depravity. Men can sin not merely from weakness, but eagerly and ruthlessly. Now, my question to you this evening is, why is that so? We think of sin as something that we just sort of fall into, we're tricked into, we're induced into. Solomon is actually pointing out that while that's true, and we can sin from weakness, we can also sin eagerly and ruthlessly. Why is that so? I'm sorry?
I just didn't hear.
Okay. Okay. That we not only sin by mistake, but we sin on purpose. I'm just paraphrasing that now. Why? Why do I sin on purpose? I'm sorry?
You enjoy it.
Yeah. What's the heart of the issue is always the issue of the heart. And what the scriptures tell me is that my heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. It tells me that I'm a fallen creature. The theologians use the term total depravity to describe the state of mankind. When Adam fell, all men fell with him. All of us inherited from him a sin nature, and all of us are totally depraved. Understand, when the Bible describes our sin condition, it's not saying, and total depravity does not mean that we are as bad as we possibly can be. Because everyone can be bad, more badder, is that the right word? Worse than they are. Even people like Hitler and Joseph Stalin did good things. They could have been worse, believe it or not, than they really were. But the point of total depravity is that we can't be as good as we need to be in order to be genuinely godly. More to the point of what Solomon is saying here and what men like Derek Kidner are affirming is that men can sin not merely from weakness but eagerly and ruthlessly. In fact, he entitled this little parable, this proverb, Bent on Evil. That a man's heart is bent that way. William MacDonald is really right to remind us that modern sociological excuses for crime simply doesn't hold water in the end. Go ahead. There you are. Yeah. Jeffrey and I were talking about his upcoming surgery for getting his wisdom teeth, and he's saying, I'm really not looking forward to that. If it really was an enjoyable thing, you'd be dreaming about it, wouldn't you? I just can't. But no, because there's going to be pain involved. Yeah. And the same thing in the area of sin. So what the Bible really is teaches us, and what Solomon is affirming here, is that the wicked person, and that's what he's talking about here, craves evil as if he were addicted to it. And he's mean even to those who are close to him. Here he speaks of his neighbor. There are some people that are just that way. You've come across those people, haven't you? That are that way. Again, William MacDonald says, the soul of the wicked is always plotting some new evil, and he shows no mercy to his neighbor in perpetrating it. Thus his sin is both deliberate and ruthless. By the way, just think of the total denial of the biblical teaching of the fallenness of man, of our depravity, of this that kind of truth, and the fact that within our civil leaders and our court system and so forth, our legal system, there's a refusal to acknowledge that is in fact true. And so when it comes to issuing judgments and justice and dealing with crimes and criminals, we have the mess that we're in today in our legal system. Somehow that proverb made a lot more sense to me when I was working on it earlier, and as I've shared it right now, it's just that I'm not wondering if it's really connected.
There's a couple of different things I think that come to mind as you ask the question, as you talk about the answer to the question. There are different levels at which people enter into a given sinful activity.
Yes.
You know, and there's the aggressive that convinces or forces somebody to do something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Or the peer pressure, aggressive, trying to tell you you're stupid if you don't go along with it. And then there's the passive, the ones who are talked into doing something that they know is wrong, but they go ahead with it anyway.
Hmm.
You know, a friend of mine, many, many years ago, he's now a successful businessman in Hopkins now. He was on the passive side of the deal. He was talked into going into a school bus and taking out his knife and ripping up the seats just for fun. But he knew better and was dumb and didn't do it again. And the guys who were on the aggressive side, who had talked him into it or cajoled him into it, they went on to not be successful businessmen. They both were in the bus and both had their knives out. But that same thing is true. You look at any sinful community or sinful population,
mm-hmm.
whether it's thievery or homosexuality or whatever it is, there's going to be an aggressive group that are the really evil ones who really do want what is worst for somebody else. And then there's the ones who go along with it, who are talked into it, try it out for some reason. And they're doing the same thing wrong. But I guess he's talking more about the aggressive part,
yes,
instead of the passive part.
Yes. Yes. And I mentioned Joseph Stalin a while ago, but maybe Pol Pot, who was just an abysmally evil man on a large scale. You know, a million plus of his own people in Cambodia that he executed simply because they were intelligent and they would be a threat to the institution of a pure communist regime. And so if you were educated, you had to be eliminated. If you had a pair of glasses on, it meant you could read. You had enough money to buy glasses, you could read. You needed to be executed. It was a systematic purging of the culture. And at the end of his days, when he was himself dying back in the jungles and he was interviewed, they said, do you have any regrets in what you've done in your life? Nope. I'd do it again. Didn't do enough of it. Just. That's a wicked man. How about verse 11? When the scoffer is punished, the simple is made wise. But when the wise is instructed, he receives knowledge. Now, we've seen something like this before. In fact, we're going to go back to that verse in a minute. But notice there are three different people that are mentioned in this verse. Did you notice that? When the scoffer, there's the first one, is punished, the simple, there's the second, is made wise. But when the wise, there's the third, is instructed, he receives knowledge. The scoffer, the simple, and the wise. Now, there's several questions that struck me as I was reading through this again recently. Number one, what happens when the scoffer is punished here? What happens when the scoffer is punished? The simple, okay, is made wise. All right. What happens when the wise is instructed? Okay, he receives knowledge. What happens to the scoffer? Why doesn't Solomon hold out the same kind of hope for the scoffer that he does for the simple and the wise person? When the scoffer is corrected, the simple is made wise. When the wise is instructed, he gets knowledge. But the scoffer gets punishment, period, end of story. Turn over to chapter 19 for a moment. We saw a verse when we were in this chapter that's nearly identical to what Solomon has just told us here in verse 11. Chapter 19, verse 25. Strike a scoffer, and the simple will become wary. Rebuke one who has understanding, and he'll discern knowledge. So here again, there are three different people. There's a scoffer, there's a simple person, and there's one who has understanding. That would be the counterpart to the wise in verse 11 in chapter 21 that we were looking at. Gary Kidner is pointing out that really you have three variations of mindsets here. There's a closed mind. The scoffer's mind apparently is closed. The simple person is an empty mind, and the person who's wise or understanding has an open mind. And when we came through this verse some while back and we looked at that, I could almost anticipate an outsider listening in and saying, Pastor, you're being awfully judgmental. I mean, here are these three people. How dare you judge those three people and saying one person's mind is closed and another's empty and another is open? And my response would be, well, I'm not being judgmental. I'm simply telling you what Solomon observed. But Solomon is observing it with his eyes open. He's making an open-eyed, realistic assessment. How so? Because from the very beginning, he's told us that one of the characteristics of a scoffer, and if you're reading from the NIV, it uses the synonym mocker, sometimes the word scorner. But one of the characteristics of this person is the fact that he's a recalcitrant. It's a word we don't often use, but it's an important word here. Here's a person who, even when he's flogged, even when he's punished, doesn't learn from his painful experience. Look at verse 29 here in chapter 19. Judgments are prepared for scoffers and beatings for the backs of fools. That's true, but apparently those judgments and beatings have little consequences on them. Even when that happens, they don't learn. I have a note in my particular Bible that says the scoffer has gone beyond the simple lack of judgment, and he's made a conscious decision for evil. And the efforts to correct that kind of person fail. In fact, they may even backfire. So that's an important backdrop here as we're looking at this thought this evening. Because in giving the instructions, you see, to smite a scoffer, to strike him, he doesn't really give the prospect that the scoffer is going to profit from his punishment. Did you notice that? That's what we were observing back in chapter 21 when we were looking at that, but here it is also. The idea in punishing the scoffer is not necessarily that he'll be corrected by it. It might work on occasion. That would be good. But I suppose on the one hand, the purpose in this is to exercise justice. That is, if the scoffer has done something wrong, there needs to be punishment. There needs to be justice served. So that's good. But more to the point, Solomon says here that when this is done, there's a benefit to other people. The simple become wary. The simple become wary. When Solomon uses that word simple, who is he talking about? If you and I use it in 21st century America, we call somebody a simp or a simpleton. It may not be quite the same connection. When Solomon speaks of somebody who is simple, who's he referring to? Do you remember? Yes, untaught. We often it's associated with a youth, and so there's a naivete that's there. You talked about John a moment ago. You talked about people who, some people are just bad, and they're the aggressing person in something. They're conjuring up evil, and they're leading the way. There are others that can just be led along in it. A simple person is on that score. He's naive. He's open to things that are foolish. But he's sort of open-minded. That would be one of the ways we would describe that person. So Solomon says here, when you strike the scoffer in verse 25, the simple will become wary. The scoffer may not learn a thing from his pain and punishment, but at least this other party, the simple person, the naive person, may be jarred awake and becomes aware of this. By the way, that's another reason why punishing criminals quickly and in some public way can be a good thing, can have a positive role to play. Let's go back to chapter 21 then. So here are those three parties again, verse 11 of chapter 21. When the scoffer is punished, the simple is made wise, but when the wise is instructed, he receives knowledge. So when a person who is wise receives verbal instruction, it may be painful to him to be corrected, and yet he listens to it, and he receives that word of correction. He receives that knowledge, and he acts on it. Comments or observations in that, Ken?
Would the word scoffer refer to someone who is habitually criticizing another person, another group of people, in an effort to mean or to lessen what they stood for? Or if that person's own pain, politically or otherwise?
You know, just be real honest here. I haven't been able to nail that down real hard. You know, when I think of mocker, scorner, scoffer, certain ideas come to my mind. But here's a person who may do it. Something happens in a news item. Here's a politician who does something. Here's a particular view, and there's something that's there, and they scoff at that, and yet that's not their normal predisposition. That's not their normal habit in doing it. There's a response there. I'm wondering if there's something different about this person. That is, it's much more ingrained, and it's they're more the norm than the exception. I wonder if you...
Someone who is innocent and scoffing. get to Sarah Palin or to Dan Quayle.
There you go.
That would be a scoffing kind of a thing to make light of honesty and honorable behavior. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I was watching Fox News today.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think you would either be saying the truth. So, but that seems to be so much how people who stand up for the truth are met in the media by people who scoff, not even refute what they stand up for with facts and evidence to the contrary. Whereas, if Nancy Pelosi was met with the truth and shown to be what she really is, then that's when why the simple seeing the discourse would say, oh, I see. And they are thereby made wiser. And also wise receiving the instruction.
So they actually receive it. They will receive it.
Well, the wise would, and also the simple, if they are open to receiving the truth, would become wise. Mm-hmm. Not only would they receive the truth as to that subject, but also they would receive the truth as to that person who was scoffing, the person who was telling the truth, or making light of it.
What's that?
Makes sense.
Okay.
I was just kind of trying to figure out what the context of the scoffer was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, y'all went into scoffers very often.
It's interesting that you're bringing it up, and I'm glad you did, because there are lots of those in my mind, but that's one of those fuzzy, that's a kind of a cloudy area. I'm not nearly as clear on that as I need to be. And this is a good exchange that's going on to move towards some clarity that way. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay. This is a good place to stop for the evening. NL? We haven't called on you to pray yet this evening. Would you dismiss us in a word of prayer? Thank you.